And that word preached is found in Job chapters 40 and 41 today. The animal kingdom has long been a source for symbols, archetypes in the human kingdom. When devising the presidential seal, for example, our founders chose, of course, the bald eagle. But in looking at the first draft of that seal, Benjamin Franklin speculated that the character of the bald eagle represented there did not compare well with the bird there, who he said looks more like a turkey. And there's been representations of that very first seal, and that bald eagle looks pretty silly. He doesn't look very fearsome. Doesn't look very intimidating. And Franklin just rode this to the end for everything he could get. He goes on to say, "For in truth, a turkey is in comparison a much more respectable bird, and withal a true original native of America. He is besides, though a little vain and silly, a bird of courage, and would not hesitate to attack a grenadier of the British Guards who should presume to invade his farmyard with a red coat on." We've had turkeys, and yeah, they'll chase you around the yard. I like them better than goats. So, although Franklin was not officially recommending that the turkey be our national bird, that's one of those national myths, he was saying, with tongue in cheek, that the turkey's fighting spirit was more original to America than the predating, cowardly behavior of the bald eagle. Even so, the deed was done, and the bald eagle has been our national bird ever since. And although Franklin was absolutely correct in observing that the eagle is by nature a scavenger on a par with the vulture doesn't look nearly so noble as the eagle, though. It is nevertheless a closely related species. The bald eagle still looks noble, sleek, brave, and elegant. It is therefore a proper emblem for America. And over the centuries, this simple emblem on the presidential seal has come to dominate not only other governmental seals and documents, but come to represent, like no other creature, the fierce fighting spirit of America. 101st Airborne, for example, the Screaming Eagles. We got Eagle on the National Seal, the Dollar Seal, the U.S. Army Seal. And so the bald eagle has joined the pantheon of animals that represent nations. Whether in political cartoons or speeches by statesmen, anthems, songs about the nations, right? For example, in contemporary parlance, the eagle represents America. The bear represents Russia, the lion represents Great Britain, and the dragon, of course, represents China. Well, the ancient world is no exception to this profound human tendency to personify national traits with characteristics in the animal realm. Job does this in the text before us, and in a sense sets the pattern for all of Scripture to come. Remember, this is early in Revelation. All of the Old Testament and New Testament will hereafter characterize threatening, menacing political kingdoms of pagan origins as beasts. Beasts from the land and or beasts from the sea. And they are so because they're founded in wickedness and evil, having its roots in the evil one. Even as we have observed that the original serpent, right, in our reading from the law, was more subtle than all the beasts of the field. Let us observe how Job, the book of Job, sets the standards for these biblical metaphors, lays the groundwork for these biblical metaphors. And if you're going to understand the book of Revelation, you need to understand the book of Job and the Old Testament first. Okay. Let us look to our chapters then. Our first point that I'd like to make with you inscrutable. Number two, once again, the Lord is overwhelming Job. He's stunning him into silence by asserting that vast, sovereign, and potent, my will and ways are inscrutable to you, O creature, regarding the beast from the land. Now, last week we saw the Lord overwhelm Job with his magnificent presence and stun him into silence with his challenge to go ahead and take the reins of nature. Go ahead, Job, guide the course of providence over all things for the good. Where were you when I laid the foundations of the earth? He said. Have you commanded the morning since your days began? Can you bind the chains of the Pleiades or loose the cords of Orion? Can you hunt the prey for the lion? Is the wild ox willing to serve you? Right? But more importantly, there was the implicit challenge to bring about the good. Can you bring about the good in these providential guidances, Job? For example, can you bring about joy and beauty when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy as they did when I created the world? Can you, Job, defeat and bring to naught the evil as well as bring about the good? For example, can you command the dawn to take hold of the skirts of the earth and the wicked be shaken out of it? As Elihu has tirelessly pointed out to us, Job's sin is that he has questioned God's justice in his treatment of him. And what Elihu and now God himself have reminded Job of is that his view of things is narrow, focused only on his own miserable circumstances. In the greater scheme of things, Job's suffering does indeed have reasons and purposes that may not be revealed to him here and now. That's been one of the principles we had that have guided us all the way through the book of Job, right? But which nevertheless have an integral part in redemptive history. Job's sufferings nevertheless have an integral part in redemptive history. We have also seen that. No one knows this better than the reader. For a lot of this, Job is ignorant. Job will never know the reasons and purposes for his suffering. But we do. But what about the dominion of man? Who is sovereign there? Are the circumstances such that God is powerful enough to tame evil and temper the good? To this in particular, God now turns in his challenge to Job in the dominion of man. And in doing so, he will employ two metaphors from the animal realm that will, in turn, become absolutely standard throughout the rest of Scripture. We're going to be looking at apocalyptic literature here in the future, and the book of Revelation as well. So this is crucial for understanding apocalyptic literature and the book of Revelation in particular, because these two metaphors from the animal realm will become absolutely standard throughout the rest of Scripture. What are they? Let's begin with our text. Let's look at chapter 40, verses 1 through 5 first. And the Lord said to Job, "Shall a fault finder contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it." Then Job answered the Lord and said, "Behold, I am of small account. What shall I answer you? I lay my hand on my mouth. I have spoken once and I will not answer twice, but I will proceed no further." These verses are really a response to God's previous defeat of Job in the wrestling match of wisdom. Remember, we saw that, "Gird up your loins like a man, Job." That is, tie your belt around your waist and let's begin to wrestle. "Who is this that darkens counsel by words without knowledge? Dress for action like a man," or "gird up your loins like a man. I will question you and you make it known to me." And of course, Job has not been able to wrestle with God, to contest with God. he has tapped out in the first round. God is requiring an acknowledgement of this here. And the Lord said to Job, shall a fault fighter contend with the Almighty? He who argues with God, let him answer it. So Job admits defeat in this first round. But God is not finished. Certainly, Job cannot hold sway over the elements of nature or the creatures that God has made. Yet he's a man. A whole realm remains untouched by our wrestling contest, that of men. As a man, Job, perhaps you can bring about good and defeat the evil in the realm of man. What so? Chapters or verses 6 through 14 then of chapter 40. Let's look to them. 6 through 14. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, dress for action like a man. I will question you and you make it known to me. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? Have you an arm like God? And can you thunder with a voice like his? Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. Sovereign sarcasm. You hear the note of sovereign sarcasm in this text. And with these words, round two of the wrestling match commences. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind once again and said, dress for action like a man. That is, gird up your loins like a man. Round two, buddy. I will question you and you make it known to me. Become a revelator, Job. You reveal these things to me. And the Lord reminds Job here of the premise for the match. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right? Instead of debating the merits of one position over the other, God stuns Job into silence once more with the sheer power of good. Have you an arm like God? That is, the power to bring about good. And can you thunder with a voice like his? That is, command the good by fiat power of your word. Can you create ex nihilo? If so, Job, then I'm prepared to loan you the throne of sovereignty to see how you conduct yourself. You're the sovereign sarcasm here. Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger. And look on everyone who is proud and abase him. Look on everyone who is proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Send them to hell. Let's see if we can do this then, Job, huh? Oh, Job, if indeed you have judged correctly in the matter of your own experience, then you must be competent to judge in all the other cases of justice. Go ahead and do so. Vent your righteous indignation and put in his precise place the proud man and crush all the wicked men, consign them to hell where they belong. Can you do this thoroughly, missing no one, and doing it with exact justice? Missing no jot or tittle of justice and no minutia of mercy. Wow, if you can do this, Job, I'm yours. Then I will also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. Here's the steering wheel, Job. My father threw my little brother into the back seat when he took me out to learn how to drive a three-speed stick. I was 15. My brother was 12. My brother laughed at me when I made the car lurch and stall and quit getting the hang of the clutch, right? You remember those days, guys? I can do that, he said. Let me try. I can drive. Eventually, after giving me plenty of opportunity to learn, my dad gave a long moment of silence and then said, okay, Steve, come on up here. He called my brother's bluff. He could barely see over the steering wheel. His adolescent feet couldn't reach the pedals. He ground the gears of the starter and flooded the carburetor when he tried to start it. He never asked again, and he never teased me either again. How embarrassing a moment it would be for Joe if he were put in charge of the universe, even for a moment. We'd still be recovering. Talk about a hurricane. My brother would have had a better chance of winning the Indy 500 at 12 than for Job to work the levers of the universe. The Lord then takes up a concrete example of how difficult a task it would be to bring the wicked to justice and to tame evil. Let's just get a hold of one of my wildest, strongest creatures and see how you master him. Let us read about this creature. Verses 15 to 24. Job 40, 15 to 24. Behold, Behemoth, which I made as I made you, eats grass like an ox. Behold, his strength is in his loins, and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff as a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze, his limbs like bars of iron. He is the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. For the mountains yield food for him, where all the wild beasts play. Under the lotus plants he lies, in the shelter of the reeds and in the marsh. For his shade, the lotus trees cover him. The willows of the brooks surround him. Behold, if the river is turbulent, he is not frightened. He is confident, though Jordan rushes against his mouth. Can one take him by his eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? That creature which Job is bidden to bring to heel here, Behemoth. Behemoth. This is a transliteration of the Hebrew, which in the singular is translated as beast, but in the plural, when it refers to a singular beast, it is called a plural of majesty. And that's what we have here, Behemoth, a plural of majesty. This is a beastly beast, a beast which transcends all other beasts. Christopher Ashe calls him super beast in our parlance. In fact, God calls it such in verse 19. He is the first of God's works. It doesn't mean first in the order of creation, but first in primacy. So, this super beast, his description is in the details characteristic of the hippopotamus. Many speculate that this is all he's talking about, but the language does transcend these details. The hippopotamus is an herbivore, of course, with limbs like stubby pillars. Behold, his strength is in his loins and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar. The sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs like bars of iron. He's at home on land or in the river, though Jordan rushes against his mouth, right? No one can tame him or capture him. Can one take him by the eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? You're not going to see one of these in the circus. God himself is alone capable of bringing him to account, even this warily. Let him who made him bring near his sword. So here, before you, you have now the beginning of the tradition which links evil and the evil one with this super beast, the beast from the land. early Revelation. As the bald-headed eagle started out as a simple and, in the original seal, a silly-looking creature, develops in the American tradition into the screaming eagle. Well, here we have the beginning of that link between the beast from the land and the beast who indeed tempted Adam and Eve. Because from the garden onward, Satan is emblemized as a beast, isn't he? Daniel records, will record subsequently, Daniel will subsequently record God's reducing Nebuchadnezzar, as we read this morning, from glory to his actual behavioral state, that of a beast in the field. The greatest king in history, the golden head of the image, right? A beast. We begin to link kings and kingdoms with beasts. Daniel as well, in his prophecies, pictures kings as a variety of beasts, most notably Alexander the Great as a goat. Alexander the Great as a goat. That kind of takes the sheen of glory off of Alexander. How great can he be if Daniel pictures him as a goat? And then, of course, John draws upon this rich background, and I've only sketched just in a few cases the associations of beasts and nations and kings and princes and stars, right? Falling stars, princes, and animals. John draws upon this rich background to tap Satan personified as the beast from the land. For example, chapter 13, verse 11. Then I saw another beast rising out of the earth, John says in Revelation. It had two horns like a lamb, and it spoke like a dragon. That first beast from the land begins his journey here, in this text. So before you ever go to the book of Revelation, have your head on straight in the Old Testament first. So we are looking at the very beginnings then of this tradition here in this patriarchal literature, in the midst of a patriarchal lawsuit. But this is not all, a beast from the land. Point two, chapter 41. Inscrutable. Once again, God is challenging Job to have a will and way equal to his. He says, vast, sovereign, and potent, my will and ways are inscrutable to you, O creature, regarding the beast from the sea. Chapter 41. Let's read verses 1 through 34, the whole thing, shall we? Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook, or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to take him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird? Or will you put him on a leash for your girls? Will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hands on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, the hope of a man is false. He is laid low even at the sight of him. No one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. Who then is he who can stand before me? Who has first given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. Let's stop there for just a minute. This text drips with sovereign sarcasm, doesn't it? Christopher Ashe, the commentator, he has a ball with this text. In commenting on, will you put this beast on a leash for your girls? He says, just imagine having him as a family pet, as you would a parrot, or put him on a leash as you would with a family dog. Imagine coming home one evening, ringing the doorbell, and your little daughter answers and gives you a kiss. Hello, darling, you say. I brought you a pet. Oh, thank you, Dad. It's called a Leviathan. And then this monster roars in and devours the whole family. And he goes on through the whole sequence here. He says, this is dark humor, and it's meant to be. You're not going to find this beast at the fish market on the floor ready to be auctioned, right? At the Tsukiji floor in Tokyo each morning, right? At the fish market there, you're not going to find this guy. Or in this Seattle farmer's market, you're not going to find this guy laid out, cut up, and ready to sell. No. He's not going to be divided up among the merchants, is he? Sovereign sarcasm. Job, I'm the only one that can handle this guy. No one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. Who then is going to stand before me? Right? He says to Job. Who has first given to me that I should repay him? And Paul directly cites this, doesn't he, in the book of Romans. Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. He goes on then in verse 12. I will not keep silence concerning his limbs, or his mighty strength, or his goodly frame. Who can strip off his outer garments? Who would come near him with a bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth is terror. His back is made of rows of shields, shut up closely as with a seal. One is so near to another that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. Out of his mouth go flaming torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils come forth smoke, as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame comes forth from his mouth. In his neck abides strength, and terror dances before him. The folds of his flesh stick together, firmly cast on him and immovable. His heart is hard as a stone, hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. At the crashing, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it does not avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He counts iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. For him, sling stones are turned to stubble. Clubs are counted as stubble. He laughs at the rattle of javelins. His underparts are like sharp potsherds. He spreads himself like a threshing sledge on the mire. He makes the deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. Behind him he leaves a shining wake. One would think the deep to be white hair. On earth there is none like his. There is none his like, excuse me. On earth there is not his like. A creature without fear. He sees everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride. Now, many have observed that this too is an exaggerated description, hyperbole, describing another of God's fearsome creatures, the crocodile. And there's many likenesses, there's many dovetailings, aren't there, in the description of this beast with the crocodile. But there's more. Much, much more that becomes associated with this beast from the sea. The beast from the sea. This beast becomes the dragon of Scripture. The word that the Septuagint uses to translate Leviathan is this, dragon. Listen to the description of a dragon. His sneezing flash forth light. His eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. And you know the yellow eyes, the reptilian eyes of the crocodile, right? And out of his mouth go flaming torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Out of his nostrils come forth smoke as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals and a flame comes forth from his mouth, i.e. the dragon. This sea serpent, which in other portions of Scripture is sometimes called Rahab, the writhing serpent of the sea becomes associated with beastly nations that threaten the promised land, most notably Egypt, right? Babylon, too, is called a beast, a dragon, a monster. From Jeremiah 51, Nebuchadnezzar, the king of Babylon, has devoured me. He has crushed me. He has made me an empty vessel. He has swallowed me like a monster. And then the chapter 51 of Jeremiah goes on to describe a sea monster-like being that devours Israel. So you have then lands and kings and kingdoms and nations that threaten the promised land described as beasts, beginning here. And John, then, and when we come to Revelation, once again, I've only sampled, just given you a taste of this motif all through Scripture that begins here in early Revelation, that is patriarchal literature here in the book of Job. John has all of this rich imagery upon which to draw when he identifies Leviathan as Satan, right? And the great dragon, i.e. Leviathan, was thrown down, that ancient serpent who is called the devil and Satan, the deceiver of the whole world. It begins here. He was thrown down to the earth and his angels were thrown down with him. So keep these, this rich tradition, this rich tapestry of imagery, which John's first readers would have had marshaled, wouldn't they? In their reading, they would have had this, all, okay, we're on your train, John. We're riding with you. We know where you're going with this. So many modern interpreters, modern students of the Bible, don't. They're off the rails in interpreting Revelation because they do not understand the rich tapestry and background that John brought to the book of Revelation. And the Lord himself indicates of whom he speaks as well as he concludes his speech to Job. He says, on earth there is not his like, a creature without fear. He sees everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride, i.e. the one in counsel with the sons of God, that is the deceiver, the adversary, the Satan. King of the sons of pride, right? The beast who has no equal. Ezekiel has this text in mind when he describes the casting down of Satan from heaven. As he says in chapter 28, because your heart is proud, and you have said, I am a god, I sit in the seat of the gods, in the heart of the seas. King of the sons of pride. Luther has this very text in mind as he composed a mighty fortress. The ancient prince of hell, as one English translation puts it, the ancient prince of hell has risen with purpose fell. Strong mail of craft and power he weareth in this hour. On earth is not his equal, right? So indeed, as we move on to the apocalyptic literature in the Bible, most notably Revelation, you must keep in mind Job and the Old Testament from which all of these images and metaphors grow organically. This is not the full-blown image the Old Testament will bring to the beast from the land and the beast from the sea, but here it is in germ form, in seed form, and it will flourish and grow just like that silly little eagle that looked more like a vulture or a turkey did to Ben Franklin. That image will grow and flourish into full-blown form by the time we do get to Revelation. Well, can Job do it? Can Job bring justice to these metaphors for evil? Can he harness evil like he might be able to harness the hippopotamus or the crocodile, the beast from the land or the beast from the sea? Go ahead, give that a try first, Job, okay? If you can do that, then maybe you can bring about good and destroy evil. We'll see next week what Job thinks. But we know now that it is only the Lamb who was slain that can bring victory over the beast, right? As John will say, he sees the dragon, i.e. Leviathan, that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan. By the time we get to Revelation in particular, he does this more for his, John does this more for his Gentile audience than he does for his Jewish audience, because they know already the dragon is that ancient serpent, Leviathan is that ancient serpent who is the devil and Satan. And he bound him for 1,000 years, as we'll see in Revelation 20, and ultimately cast him into the lake of fire. It is this lamb who was slain. Another beautiful animal metaphor, right? This lamb who was slain, who brought about this victory and defeated this mighty dragon, this mighty Leviathan. But we have intimations of that right here in Job, as he is bidden the impossible. None of us would be able to do this. Job wasn't able to do it. John wept because there was no one found who could break the seals until the lamb who was slain steps up. It is made possible only by the power of the risen Christ. Well then, with that in mind, let us now come to that place where we do see the power of his blood. The lamb who was slain, who does defeat the mighty dragon, the Leviathan. We see that power of his blood in the simple elements of the